Hi, it's Bill in the US.
And Matt in the UK.
So, you know how when you haven't been talking for a while, before you open your mouth to speak, you do a little throat clearing?
Right, you know, just to loosen up the pipes.
Exactly. That's what this episode is.
Yes, we're clearing our throats in preparation for a return to our usual format with episode 16 on June the 12th.
So please enjoy now, won't you? Our phlegmy throat clearing. We're starting. We've started. Okay, so what are we doing here?
We're doing a very special episode.
Ooh.
Of Dawson's Creek.
Are we doing an after-school special? This kind of feels like...
Yeah, this will be... it'll be entertaining, but it'll also teach the kids to stay away from drugs.
Excellent.
Okay, so what we're doing here is we are discussing a film that I think is good.
Sorry. Sorry.
Yeah, that little snort might clue the listeners into your stance on this work of culture.
I had something stuck in my throat.
Okay, sure. So this is a film called Out for Justice, starring the action star and resolutely worst person on the planet, Steven Seagal. Now, I want to make it really clear before we get into the film that I'm not a fan of Steven Seagal. Steven Seagal, well, I kind of am, but on every conceivable level, he is a legendarily horrific human being. He is known for deliberately hurting stuntmen on the sets of his films to make sure they understand who's the big dog is. He's friends with Vladimir Putin. He is a man for whom the entire hashtag MeToo movement symbolizes an average Tuesday afternoon. He is unspeakably awful. He got sacked from his own fake reality TV show.
Steven Seagal, Lawman?
Lawman, yes.
Oh.
And he got sacked. That whole show got shut down because of credible allegations of human trafficking. I mean, that's something.
Just to give our listeners some sense, by the way, of the scope of this guy's scumbaggery, entirely putting aside the question of whether or not he can act, is in Wikipedia, the comprehensive online encyclopedia that anybody with an AOL account can edit, what could possibly go wrong? In the entry for Steven Seagal, in the sidebar that breaks out the various components of the article, there is an entire section in the sidebar titled Allegations and Lawsuits. And it contains the following line items. 1995 lawsuit, 2010 lawsuit, 2011 lawsuit, 2017 allegations, and 2020 federal securities violation settlement, which was, I looked it up, for a Bitcoin scam, because of course it was. And the penalty for that was that Seagal had to pay $157,000 in actual cash money, not Bitcoin, but real U.S. dollars, presumably. $157,000 in what the SEC calls, this is the part I love, disgorgement.
Disgorgement.
Disgorgement. He had to pay $157,000 in disgorgement. So what we're saying is, this is not a good guy. On this, we can agree.
He's not a good guy. This is my favorite little quote that I fixed on as a reference point. The Australian writer, Clive James, one of my favorite writers, famously, I think in the 70s, described Arnold Schwarzenegger as looking like a condom stuffed full of walnuts, which is beautiful.
Yeah.
Which I think makes Steven Seagal an old sock half full of tapioca.
That's fair.
Yeah. Also, he can't run.
There should be a whole subgenre of movies broken out by actors who can run versus actors who can't run. Robert Redford, good runner.
Mm.
Tom Cruise, excellent runner. Daniel Craig, pretty good runner. Harrison Ford, not good, not a good runner. And Steven Seagal, oh my God. He makes Harrison Ford look like Robert Redford.
He runs like Donald Duck.
Yeah.
All kind of chaotic flapping. So that all said, Steven Seagal is a bad person. But this film is good.
I want to be clear on the concept here. You're not just suggesting that this is one of those movies that's so bad it's good. You're actually saying this is a good movie.
I think I am. I think every other Steven Seagal movie ever made, and there are many of them, to some degree, falls into the so bad it's good category.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this one, Out for Justice, 1991, I think it's genuinely good. I think it's gritty. I think it's got something.
Well, I would agree with you that it's got something. I just think we disagree about what that is.
Okay, I think I see what you're saying.
It was directed, Out for Justice, in 1991 by a guy named John Flynn. It cost $14 million and went on to make $39 million, so objectively a hit at the box office. John Flynn, by the way, was in his day being the early 70s, a pretty good director of action movies. The peak of his career was he directed a very good actioner in 1973, a movie called The Outfit with Robert Duvall. Out for Justice is Know the Outfit, is all I can say about that.
Well, Out for Justice has a scene in which Steven Seagal beats somebody up with a salami. Does The Outfit have that?
Hang on, I'm checking my notes.
Okay.
No, it does not.
I think it's apparent which film is of the higher cinematic quality.
So to set the scene here, this is a movie which is set entirely in Brooklyn, and it's the kind of action movie that is, on some level, a little ashamed of being an action movie because it begins with an epigram from Arthur Miller, which I will now share. Shall I share it?
Mm-hmm, please.
While to the stranger's eye, one street was no different from another, we all knew where our neighborhood somehow ended. Beyond that, a person was a stranger. Arthur Miller, playwright, raised in Brooklyn.
Because at its heart, this film is about community. It's about neighborhood and family and salami violence.
Before we dive into Out for Justice, is there anything else we need to know about the titling of Steven Seagal movies?
I'm so glad you asked. This is his fourth, I believe. Yeah, fourth film. And it is in the middle of what is called by Seagalophiles.
I'm sorry, called by?
Seagalophiles.
Okay.
Stevedores. This is his golden age.
Uh-huh.
This is just before he got big famous. This is when he did four films that were kind of not straight to video, but nearly. You know, low budget, you know, in the great kind of heyday of VHS martial arts films. And all these films have three-word titles. In fact, most of his films throughout his entire career have three-word titles. Would you like to hear these titles?
Nothing would give me greater pleasure.
Okay, in chronological order, the Steven Seagal three-word titles are Above the Law, Hard to Kill, Marked for Death, Out for Justice, On Deadly Ground, Fire Down Below, Half Past Dead, Out of Reach, Into the Sun, Today You Die, Mercenary for Justice, Flight of Fury, Against the Dark, A Dangerous Man, Force of Execution, that makes no sense, Code of Honor, The Asian Connection, The Perfect Weapon, Contract to Kill, Beyond the Law, and The Philadelphia Story.
Wait a second.
Hmm?
I'm pretty sure you made one of those up.
No.
There is no such movie as Into the Sun.
Fair enough. I should point out, I have seen most of these films.
Of course you have, because you're a cineast and a stevedore.
Yes!
And a Seagal... What is it? A Seagaliac? What did you call yourself?
I think stevedore's better.
Yeah. It's punchier.
Seagologist! Seagologist!
Yes.
That's the one.
Now, this is not just a movie about mooks from Brooklyn. This is a movie about a very specific kind of mooks from Brooklyn that really only exists in the movies. Seagal plays a cop named Gino Foligno, because of course he's the kind of Italian where it rhymes.
Mm-hmm.
And in the, not just at the beginning of the movie, in the pre-credits sequence of the movie, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong on this, because you've seen this movie several times more than I have. I think it may be his first line of dialogue in the whole movie. Seagal beats up a pimp, and before he gets out of the car to administer the beating, he says to his partner,
"No, no, what's he doing? He's throwing this girl a beating over here."
Because he's also the kind of Italian who says "over here" a lot. First line of dialogue in the movie, so we've set the stage.
He is Italian. We've learned something.
On the other side of the equation in this movie, we have William Forsythe, a pretty good actor, playing a giggling psycho named Richie Madonna, whose direct antecedent in the movies is a character called Tommy Udo, played by Richard Widmark in Kiss of Death in 1947. You may be familiar with this character, Matt. Tommy Udo is famous in film lore for pushing an old lady in a wheelchair down a flight of stairs.
So he was the bad guy?
I'm pretty sure. I think so.
Okay. But it's shades of gray.
It's nuanced. It begins with a killing at a fruit stand. And my theory about fruit stands in movies, have I shared this with you? Can I share this with you?
Please do.
Yeah. If there's a fruit stand in a movie, just stay away from it. Nothing good ever happens at a fruit stand in a movie. Either a car is going to drive into it, or a guy is going to get shot adjacent to it.
Yeah.
Nothing good has ever happened at a fruit stand. Nobody ever walks up to a fruit stand in a movie and says, "I'll have some of those Tangelos, please."
You are correct about fruit in movies. Fruit stands, containers of fruit in movies are there to be scattered.
Yes.
After violence. His partner that gets killed is Bobby Lupo, which you can only say the way they say in the film, Bobby Lupo!
Oh!
Oh!
Yeah.
Yeah, and gets gunned down by this William Forsythe bad guy with a moustache. A man who is made entirely out of rectangles. He's like a wardrobe. He looks like a wardrobe with a moustache.
He killed Bobby in front of his wife and kids.
In front of his wife and kids.
Oh!
Over there.
Over there.
My first favorite line in the film comes quite soon after that, when Steven Seagal's estranged wife is on the scene with Steven Seagal, who is upset about his partner being gunned down in front of his wife and kids.
Sure.
And Steven Seagal's estranged wife says, "How are you?" Which seems, I mean, you know, he's not going to be great. And Steven Seagal's response is to flap his hands at his face and go,
"No, I'm not all right. I'm fucking like this. What do you think? He was my best friend."
Which is beautiful.
He had a method moment there.
It's a real 9-year-old girl having a panic attack response.
Now we have in this general section of the movie one of my favorite lines, which is that after Richie guns down Bobby at the fruit stand, he jumps into the getaway car with his guys and immediately snarls,
"Give me the pipe. Throwing a guy right out in the street like that.
Shut up.
And a cop too.
Give me the fucking pipe. And it's going to be fucking hot.
Give me the pipe." Which is how we know the movie is social commentary. It's social commentary, Matt.
He's a victim as much as he's a perpetrator.
You know who the real giggling psycho is?
Please.
Society.
Society.
Yeah, yeah. Now, let's not forget that Steven Seagal, playing Gino Fellino, is not only a mook from the neighborhood and a cop, but he's a father over here. Oh, he's a divorced father. And as the movie begins, he's having his weekend with his kid. And we're introduced to the kid, who is essentially, for all practical purposes, is Steven Seagal Jr. And the kid's first line of dialogue is,
"Dad, can we play catch or what?"
I kind of love this kid.
Really?
How old is this kid in this film?
I think the character is supposed to be about 9 or 10, but I'm pretty sure the actor was about 30.
The fully grown guy playing the kid is further away from the camera.
Yeah.
That's how it works. Every child in every movie, that's how they do it. People don't know that, but little glimpse behind the curtain.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, this is not to say that there are not some actual good, legitimate Hollywood actors in this thing, because there are. Juliana Margulies is in this. Dominic Chianese, who went on to play Uncle Junior in The Sopranos, is here. And as Gino Fellino's boss, Jerry Orbach, as Captain Jerry Orbach. Yeah, the character Jerry Orbach has always played a cop in a trench coat. That's the guy.
And clearly filmed all of his, I believe, three scenes in one day, because one scene takes place in bright daylight, the other scene takes place in kind of twilight, and the last scene takes place at night. So that was all one day.
Yeah, I think that was the deal. They got Jerry Orbach for one day, and then he was back on the plane. Mm-hmm. Jerry Orbach gets the thankless job, by the way, of being the character who actually has to say the line in this movie.
I'm getting too old for this shit, Gino.
And also, this is 1991. There is an argument to be made that at that point in his career, Jerry Orbach was in fact not too old for this shit. He was about the right age for this shit.
That's correct. He was age appropriate for this shit.
No one ever says that, do they? I'm the target age for this shit. So, can we talk about my favorite scene in all of cinema now?
Let's do.
Okay, so there is, in this film, the greatest bar fight scene in the history of cinema, for my money.
Okay.
He walks into this seedy basement boxing bar. There's illegal bookies and people hanging out and all sorts of, you know, seediness.
Yeah, it's like the Star Wars bar for mooks.
Yes. He walks in, he starts saying, anyone seen Richie?
Anybody seen Richie?
Fuck you.
And pretty much immediately someone insults him. And he immediately responds,
is this the setting for profanity?
That's a beautiful line.
Not bad, not bad.
It clearly is.
This scene also contains my favorite line in the movie. It's the line where he says to the same guy,
you know, Vinny, I'm starting to get in a bad mood, you know? Maybe it's like a mood swing, my hormones, I don't know. You know, maybe it's my need to impose my will.
I mean, come on.
That's funny.
This is funny. And it's supposed to be funny.
Yeah.
So he beats up everyone in the bar. He manages to make the line, whose hot dog is this, in somehow threatening. He, at the beginning of the fight, he shoves a man into a telephone box and closes the door, which is kind of funny.
That would be a phone booth for you American listeners.
And then he goes around the bar beating everyone up. And by the time he reaches the phone booth again, the guy is out of it. And he just pushes him back in and closes the door again. That's funny.
That's either a funny joke or a continuity error.
Yeah, either way, yeah. I'm glad they kept it in.
And the guys in the bar sort of stand there and obediently wait their turns to get their asses kicked.
Well, of course. And at first, they are reticent because he is a policeman. And the well-dressed mob guy, I guess, in the bar, who seems to be the kind of grown-up, he says, you know, he ain't nothing without that badge and his gun. So he takes his gun out, takes all the bullets out of it, and then says,
this is your trophy. This is your trophy, okay? Come and get it.
Knock him on his ass!
Huh?
And then he beats them all up, and it's great.
You brought up the line about the hot dog. What's the line about the hot dog again?
He just walks along the bar, sort of knocking over everyone's drinks, and then he just gets to a hot dog, and he picks it up and goes,
whose hot dog is this, huh? Is it yours?
Ah, it's my hot dog!
And as I recall, it's just a naked hot dog. It's not even a hot dog in a bun. There's apparently just a hot dog sitting on the bar.
Yeah.
Because it's that kind of bar. It's a hot dog bar. It's one of those Brooklyn hot dog bars.
Can I just quickly say, and this is absolutely true, a couple of weeks ago, I was on the London Underground, you know, at the subway, coming home from a show, and it was quite late at night. It was fairly empty. There was a middle-aged woman sat a few seats down from me. She opened up her handbag, rummaged around in it, and took out a hot dog. A hot dog in a bun. No packaging. And begun to eat it. She's a hero.
Bless her heart.
Yeah.
Wow. That's impressive. There will always be an England, is what I like to...
The Queen never dies as long as she's got her handbag hot dog.
Miscellaneous bits.
Mm-hmm.
Richie, looking for guys, looking for backup,
mm-hmm.
wanders into a bad guy garage, because apparently they have those in Brooklyn.
Oh, yeah.
And he says,
hey! I'm looking for two hot shots for backup. Anybody got the balls? Huh? Anybody got the balls? How about you, Paulie? You got the fucking balls?
You got the balls?
No, I don't have the balls. Would be the correct answer. I don't have the balls and I'm working at a garage, which is how you found me. I'm at work now.
At one point, Seagal and another one of his old buddies from the neighborhood, who has since become a kind of underboss in the local gang, they're leaving a disco, the Amore Disco. And the entire movie grinds to a halt. So Steven Seagal can tell the underboss for about 11 minutes a story about a character named Uncle Pino. It's the Uncle Pino story.
I love this bit.
Now, the thing about the Uncle Pino story is it's interesting because it has absolutely nothing to do with the movie, except, I guess, to establish that these guys have history, except we already know that. But it really feels like a speech that Seagal just shoehorned into the shoot because he felt like improvising something that day. And so it's simultaneously ridiculous and unnecessary, but also kind of the most believably naturalistic acting that Seagal does in the whole movie. And I can't quite square those two things in my head.
I have a theory about this.
Okay.
I think that an hour and a half before they shot this, he was in his trailer. He got the co-star, the other actor, and the director into his trailer. And he said, I want to do a little speech because I want to tell this story that really happened to me. This really happened to me. So I want to put it in the film. And the director kind of sort of said, yeah, okay, sure, whatever, Steven, fine, you know. And I think that's why it's naturalistic, because obviously it didn't really happen to him. But Steven Seagal, as bad an actor as he is, I think what he's good at is bullshitting. He's a good liar, because there were examples of him lying throughout his career. And I think that's why he's naturalistic, because he doesn't see it as acting. He just sees it as bullshitting this director and this actor, and there happens to be a camera there.
It's not a bad theory. It's a pretty good theory. And if it's what you need to be able to live with yourself, then God bless.
It's adorable you think that I can live with myself. But it's nothing to do with this film. I don't feel I'm doing a good job of saying why this film is good, or at least why I like this film.
Hit me.
I think the reason you don't like this film, the reason you are wrong about not liking this film, you know, with all due respect, over there, what you're doing is you're comparing this film to other films. That's a mistake. You should be comparing this film to other films of its genre. When you go to a dog show, you don't judge a Chihuahua against a Great Dane, you judge things in their category. So, if you'll indulge me, Out for Justice was an American martial arts thriller released in 1991. So here are some other films that are American martial arts thrillers released in 1991.
Okay.
There was Double Impact, starring Jean-Claude Van Damme, in which he plays his own twin. They both have accents. These accents are unexplained. There is American Ninja 4, The Annihilation, which is worse than American Ninja 3, Blood Hunt. There is Showdown in Little Tokyo, which is actually good, but it is an action film that somehow finds reason for Brandon Lee to tell Dolph Lundgren, and I'm quoting directly here, that he has the biggest dick he's ever seen on a man.
Nice, yeah.
And finally, we have Martial Law. Do you see what they did there? Martial arts, martial law. Which starred legendary martial artist Cynthia Rothrock alongside legendary son of Steve McQueen, Chad McQueen. You see, so in its milieu, you know, in its context, this film is head and shoulders above the likes of American Ninja 4 Annihilation.
So what you're saying, not to be needlessly reductionist about this, what you're saying to me is that this movie clears a low bar.
It clears a low bar like an elegant limbo dancer. Ah.
Let's talk, shall we, for a second about the climactic fight scene, can we?
Mm-hmm.
What I love about the climactic fight scene is it takes place in the Brooklyn house slash apartment slash fight scene locale of recently retired hooker Juliana Margulies. And it's one of those movie apartments that seems purpose-built for an action sequence rather than being a place where anybody might plausibly live in the real world. And let me tell you what I mean by this. There's a considerable amount of time expended in this scene in which Steven Seagal stalks the bad guys around the house while walking around behind the walls. There's apparently a crawl space behind all the walls that's big enough for a guy wielding a shotgun to walk upright in. Just your basic Brooklyn house, essentially.
I mean, look, yes, you are correct. That's weird. But if that's your main problem with the film, then, you know, you haven't been paying attention.
That's fair.
There is a salami murder.
And in this scene, a corkscrew killing. Yeah. It's the kind of movie in which, in a fight sequence between the good guy and the bad guy, when the good guy discovers a corkscrew, one of two things is going to happen. He's either going to use it to kill the bad guy, or the bad guy will use it to harmlessly injure the good guy.
Yes. It's particularly, I'm going to be a martial arts geek here, that's particularly prevalent in Steven Seagal films, because Steven Seagal's martial art, Aikido, a large amount of it is the empty hand art of the samurai, originally, that six roots. So a lot of it is to do with someone charging at you with a sword, or a wakizashi, or a tanto, a dagger, or a small sword, you know. So it's basically, in Steven Seagal films, whenever a bad guy picks up a thing, it's like, yep, yeah, that's what you're going to get hit with. He's going to take that off you and hit you with it, or stick it through your face.
Yep. Any closing thoughts, Matt? You feel like you've made your case? I don't know that you've managed to budge me off my position here.
I feel like I'm the guy saying, yeah, but have you actually looked at how good Hitler's paintings are? I don't feel that. I am absolutely certain that nobody listening to this has been convinced by my argument. But I am also sure there were three people listening to this who were like, yeah, that film totally rules.
Okay. I wish I could tell you I was one of those three guys.
How many times have you seen it?
Three.
What sort of person watches a film three times if they don't like it?
It's work.
Yeah.
I did it for work. All right. I consider this conversation ended.
I really like ending it with, I consider this conversation ended. So that's that for this episode. We hope you enjoyed this little odd diversion. Season three of Imagination and Junk is, oh, good grief. We are currently working on season three of Imagination and Junk. That'll be coming soon. We will see you then.
I have nothing to add.
Nailed it.